Demonology and the Triphasic Model of Trauma, an Integrative Approach. A Good Omens fanfic written by NNM and performed by Starcatcher Betty. Chapter 2, Corrective Emotional Experiences. I'd like to talk to you about your sunglasses today, if that's all right with you. This was the first time she had ever brought them up herself. She had been waiting previously, but now she felt it was time. It was her job, after all, to challenge him. "I'm shocked," he said, and she thought maybe he meant he was relieved. "I'm wondering, are there any times when you don't wear them?" "Of course, don't be stupid." "Such a sweetheart you are," she thought. She waited. "I don't wear them at home." He stretched out in the chair, the way he did when he wanted greater physical comfort, as if it could compensate for the other sort of discomfort he was feeling. "I don't wear them when I'm alone." "What about when you're with Ezra?" she asked. She used her most casual tone, her most practiced casual tone. "Sometimes. But not always?" "Nope." "What's it like, being with Ezra without your sunglasses on?"
"I can see right through you," he said, like he was disappointed, like she had finally failed his tests. But she hadn't. She knew she hadn't. She knew this because he hadn't changed his posture in his seat. "I'm not trying to trick you, Crowley," she shrugged. "Therapy isn't a magic act." "Want to know why I picked you?" he asked. He raised an eyebrow at her, the way he did when he wanted her to know she was in his sights.
"Sure," she said.
She was not certain if this was the right choice or not. Even an experienced professional like Aubrey Time is subject to doubt and the occasional mistake. He was deflecting, and she was letting him get away with it. But she had been the one to bring up the sunglasses this time, and if he needed to deflect away from that topic, she would let him. For now. "I looked you up, you know."
"Makes sense."
"Most people did. There was too much information online, and she wouldn't trust a client who denied having looked up any profiles of her." "You're an atheist," he said. That, she was certain, was not in any of her profiles.
"I'm sorry?"
"You're an atheist," he repeated, repositioning himself, leaning forwards, arm bolstered by his legs. He was watching her, and she could tell he was watching her. Sometimes he did that. He could be very observant. "I chose you because you're an atheist."
Several different strands of thoughts crossed through Aubrey Time's mind at once. First, she thought, how the fuck does he know that? Second, she thought, why does he care about that? Third, she thought, God damn it, he just unsettled me. He just got exactly what he wanted. Finally, she thought, how does this relate to sunglasses? Some of those strands were important insights which could have significant therapeutic value for her client. Others were wholly personal. She let herself sort the two groups apart before she responded. "It was important to you to work with someone who shared your worldview," she said, her voice as level as all her training and experience allowed it to be. He tisked. "No. I just didn't want to talk to someone who believes in eternal damnation." Part of the reason that Aubrey Time became a therapist was that she liked puzzles. She liked how humans were puzzles, how psychology was one of the last great puzzles available to science. She liked taking the frazzled, incoherent beliefs and feelings of a person and setting them all in order, getting the pieces of their identity to line up correctly. She liked the feeling of the puzzle being solved. She disliked the feeling of a puzzle that wouldn't solve. That was the feeling she had right now. It pissed her off. "How about you answer my question?" she asked, harsher than was perhaps entirely professional. "What is it like not wearing your sunglasses around Ezra?"
"It's not like anything."
"Really? Not like anything?"
She leaned forward in her seat a bit, arms bolstered by her legs, mirroring his posture back at him. She raised her eyebrows.
"I can see right through you too, Crowley."
He snorted.
She waited.
"He says he likes my eyes."
He looked away now. He settled down. "So she did too. He sees you and he likes what he sees."
Crowley's breath hitched audibly.
He hadn't expected that. And he also hadn't meant to let her perceive the extent to which he hadn't expected that. He was still looking away.
"What does it feel like when he sees you?" she insisted.
"A minute. Two. Three. 3 minutes, and he didn't move a muscle. 3 whole minutes, and she didn't either. 3 minutes of thick silence is a very long time."
"It feels like the opposite of eternal damnation."
She gave those words her whole focus. She committed them to memory. She wanted to be able to quote them later, word for word, in her notes. She worked hard to try to understand them. On one hand, she did. It was obvious what the opposite of eternal damnation would feel like. On the other hand, however, she felt like she understood nothing. Why this wording? Why this emphasis? What leads someone to say, "It feels like unconditional love," by saying instead, "It feels like the opposite of eternal damnation"? She didn't have the answers she wanted. But that wasn't what mattered. Not right now. What mattered instead was the needs of the client sitting in front of her. Head pointed off to the side. Casual posture belied by how his hands clutched at the arms of his chair.
"Thank you," she said.
He didn't respond.
"No, really, thank you,"
she repeated, and he still didn't respond. "I was being really pushy, and I know that was hard for you."
5 minutes.
"There's another reason, too." He broke the silence. He stretched out his hands, but he still didn't look at her. Like always, he expected her to be able to follow all the threads of their conversation, no matter how they shifted and doubled back.
"I like your name."
"Aubrey?" she asked, confused, surprised.
"No, no, your last name. Time."
She smiled there.
"I like plants," he said.
"I'm an herb."
"I like plants, and Angel likes herbs."
"Angel?" He made a huffy noise. She could tell that he hadn't meant to say that, and now he was paying the price.
"That's what I call Ezra sometimes. Ignore it."
"No," she thought. "No, I am not going to ignore that." But she wasn't quite sure what to make of it. She was starting to suspect that names mattered. To Crowley, that the naming of things and persons was something that affected him, something he used to measure what mattered to him in the world. She was starting to reconsider the significance of that moment, sessions earlier, when he told her to call him by his last name rather than his first.
"Time's up," she said.
He let out a breath in recognition. He nodded and shored himself up to leave, to go back to the world outside her office doors.
"Right," he said.
"See you next week?" she asked, the way she did every week. He nodded. He stood, he moved to the door, and he opened it. He hovered for a moment.
"See you next week, Herb," he said, and then he left.
For Aubrey Time, professional therapist, that
felt like a victory. "I just don't want to take them off in here," he said. It was repetitive. He had said this exact thing almost every session for over a month now. He said it in sessions where otherwise neither of them made any other reference to his sunglasses. He said it as if she kept asking him to take them off. She hadn't, not once. But she understood that Crowley needed to act as if she had. Over and over again, he needed to repeat this conversation. Professional therapists, like Aubrey Time, liked to complain about representations of psychotherapy in the media. They've all seen The Sopranos and Good Will Hunting and Analyze This and In Session. Most of them have enough personal insight to admit they thrill at seeing their profession glamorized. But they also love getting to gripe about how inaccurate these representations of the therapeutic process are. One of the most significant misrepresentations of psychotherapy was how fast it went, how easily progress was made, how meaningful the therapist's professional insight was to helping the client heal. As a professional therapist, Aubrey Time knew how little her interpretations of her clients were worth. She had, she felt, a pretty good interpretation of Crowley's sunglasses by this point. If this were a TV show, she might confront Crowley and say something like, "Don't you get it by now? You keep saying you don't want to take them off because you're scared. You're scared, Crowley, but you want to be seen. You want me to see you." Also, if it were a TV show, she might say something like, "I'm not your mother. I won't reject you if you would just let me see you." She would say this in a TV show because TV writers couldn't get over Freud, and fictional psychotherapists always knew more about their clients' mothers than their clients were willing to say. Of course, Aubrey Time suspected that Crowley had, in fact, suffered some other trauma much earlier in his life, in some way related to his family of origin. He displayed all the classic signs of it. But he had never once, not once, said anything about his mother. She had never asked about her either, because again, she wasn't into the whole Freudian approach to things. In a TV show, a dramatic monologue like that would be exactly what Crowley would need to remove his sunglasses, and then he'd be healed. Aubrey Time and Anthony Crowley, however, didn't live in a TV show. In real life, in the world they inhabited, therapeutic progress could go slow. It could be repetitive. It could be the same client coming in week after week, displaying the exact same problem, saying the exact same words over and over again. It could be goddamn boring. It was meaningful because that sort of repetitive process was what the client needed to do. On TV, the hard work of therapy was the therapist's job. In real life, it was always the client's. The therapist's job, in Aubrey Time's professional opinion, was to offer the space for the clients to do that hard work, to encourage the direction of that work, and to allow herself to be bored when the work was repetitive. In other words, Aubrey Time was satisfied to let Crowley bore her, to a point, at least. "Let me ask you this," she said, trying a different tact than she had the previous time Crowley had insisted he didn't want to remove his sunglasses, and the time before that, and before that as well. "Is it that you don't want to take them off in here, or that you don't want me to see you take them off?" "What?" "What do you think it would be like just to take them off in here without me seeing?" "Don't be stupid," he scoffed, because Crowley still had the emotional insight of a gnat. "Try again," she said. She had enough of his trust by this point that she knew she could be a bit of a dick. She knew it worked with him. "It would be..." He let one hand circle around in the air as he thought. Completely fine. It wouldn't matter at all.
Yeah?
She raised her eyebrows. She rested her chin on her hand. I've had plenty of experience around humans without my glasses on, believe me, he said. This was another thing he did sometimes when he wasn't paying attention. He said humans, where anyone else would say people. She kept note of it, like she kept note of his allusions to the Bible, to angels, to damnation. She had no idea what any of it meant. That's what kept Crowley interesting, even when the work he needed to do was so boring. So let's try it, she said, casual, shrugging, playing chicken. I can go over there. She pointed to the side, to the window that overlooked her building's parking lot. And I'll stay there, and you can take your sunglasses off. His jaw set. He tapped his fingers on the chair's armrest. Bluff called, she thought. Or, she softened, I can go over there and I won't look, and you can decide whether to take your sunglasses off or not. He was thinking. Willing to humor me? That got him to relent, as she suspected it would. Aubrey Time knew Crowley well enough by this point to know that the best way to get him to do something was to present it as if it were a favor to her. Fine, he said. Okay. She nodded. It was a very intentional nod. It was the sort of nod that said, I know this is serious, even if you won't admit it. Once I'm facing the window, I won't look back until you say it's okay. Fine, he repeated. She gave that nod again, and then she stood. She walked over to the window. She looked out at the cars parked below. She waited. Aubrey Time relied heavily on visual information to do her job. She watched the facial expressions, body posture, and she looked out for every hint of how her client was feeling and thinking. It was uncomfortable giving up that crutch. She leaned into her other senses, especially her hearing. She could hear Crowley breathing. Talk to me, she said. What do you want me to say? She heard Fabric move. He was shifting in the seat. This is stupid. Is it? He made a grunt. So, how about it? We're here now. Want to try taking them off? She could hear him breathing. She could hear him shift. She could hear him make a sound like a sigh. There. Are you happy? He said, which she guessed was his way of saying he'd done it. She breathed in deeply to remind him how serious she was taking this. Wow, she said. She was walking a tightrope. She needed to acknowledge how momentous it was so that he could acknowledge how momentous it was. But if she went even slightly too far with it, he'd clam up and get angry. So, tell me how it feels. Stupid. Got that. What else does it feel like? He didn't respond. I can get you a list of emotion words, if you'd like. It's stupid how scared I feel. Bingo, she thought. It feels stupid and it feels scary. What else? He didn't respond. Exposed, maybe? Of course I feel exposed. You're real proud of yourself for that brilliant insight. He snapped, and she let him get away with it. Okay, she soothed. Okay, stupid, scary, exposed, hopeless. She let out a meaningful breath. I feel like the world's ending. She could barely make it out. He was talking so low. She started to worry. This might be too much. It makes no sense, he kept on. Why would doing this stupid thing make me feel like the world is ending again? She didn't know. She didn't know what again meant there, but she had a hunch. Maybe this is enough for now, she suggested. Kind. What do you think?
Yeah.
There was a pause. Okay, you can come back. When she turned around, she saw Crowley, and she saw her reflection in the sunglasses he wore. She saw him as the broken thing he was. She breathed deeply, and she returned to her seat.
Thank you for sharing that with me, she said. She thought his eyes were on her, but she wasn't sure. He didn't seem to have heard her.
Thank you.
I lost them.
His voice was flat. What's that?
In the fire, I lost them. My sunglasses. They broke.
Oh, fuck. Holy shit. Fuck, 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 she thought.
She scrambled. She reeled. She felt very bad for having been bored earlier.
You never told me that. I didn't know.
She tried to cover.
Tell me about that,
she said, and that was a mistake because they were still in phase one, still working to secure safety, and she could tell that this was not a person who currently felt safe.
He started.
His voice wavered, and then he broke off. He shook his head. I had more in the car. I got another pair. That's all.
Bullshit, she thought.
She had lost her professional footing. So she did what so many professional therapists end up doing when they have lost their professional footing. She fell back on offering an interpretation.
You know, you want to know what I think?
He looked at her. A therapist's interpretations aren't worth much. Aubrey Time often tried not to give them. It was satisfying to give an interpretation. It was satisfying to look at another person and tell them, see, here's what you are. See how I know you better than you know yourself. It usually did nothing to help. Sometimes, though, it could. I'm willing to bet, she went on, cautious and soft, when you lost your glasses in the fire, I'm willing to bet what you felt was stupid and scared and exposed and like the whole world was ending.
Crowley let out a laugh, which wasn't a laugh at all. He said, you have no idea.
And then he shook. Another thing TV portrayals of therapy get wrong is the significance of tears. Crying is important in therapy, but how and why it's important is never portrayed correctly. TV shows will often present it like it's a joke, a client sobbing into tissues while the therapist sits to the side, acting like a vestigial limb. In real life, in real therapy, in the sort of therapy Aubrey Time does, some of the therapist's most important work is done while the client cries. A therapist is witnessed and participant, offering her empathy and compassion, using those tools to help the client feel what he needs to feel, express what he may very well not know how to express without her. When a client cries, Aubrey Time knew, it is her task to ensure that it was a corrective emotional experience, something through which the client could heal. It was especially important with clients like Crowley, clients who presented with anger and deflection rather than sorrow and pain. Their tears were rare, hard for them to let out. When a client like that cried, it crystallized for her why she thought the work was meaningful, more than simply an opportunity to solve interesting puzzles. Aubrey Time was an atheist, but she couldn't avoid turning to religious language to describe how much of it meant when a client like Crowley trusted her enough to cry in front of her. It was grace. She was unworthy of it, and she was blessed by it.
She knew if she told him any of that, Crowley would laugh uproariously. She was starting to get his sense of humor. But she wouldn't tell him that. Not on her life. She would not at all, do anything to turn his attention away from the tears he needed to let fall. "Ground rules," he said. "Okay," she said. She had no idea what these would be ground rules for, given that this was the first thing he had said in this session. But ground rules, as a general concept, was the sort of thing that a therapist like Aubrey Time was most definitely in favor of. "I take them off at the end of the session, right before I leave." She laughed. She couldn't help it. "Fuck off, you idiot," she thought with affection. "No, Crowley, seriously? No way I'm agreeing to that." He was disappointed. He sat further back in his chair. "If you take them off, you're not getting out of that seat without a very thorough and uncomfortable conversation about it." Ground rules. "Fine, then I'm not taking them off." "Fine. You're a pain in the arse, Herb." She shrugged. He didn't upset her. "Maybe we can work something out. Maybe not for today, but for the next session. We can set up some mutually acceptable ground rules. And next session would then be when it happened." He thought about that. He folded his arms in front of himself and he sucked in a breath. "I told Ezra about you," he said.
"Oh, yeah?"
She tried to sound casual and professional, but she knew she didn't succeed. He surprised her with that on purpose. She knew he did. Sometimes it was like he was nourished by those moments where he got her to do her job wrong.
"Mm-hmm," he said.
"And?"
He shrugged. "He wants to meet you."
That was interesting. It was interesting to her because joint sessions can be very useful, especially in cases of trauma. Later in the process, once they had done more work with his trauma narrative, it could be very useful for him to share it with such a close friend, especially given the role that friend had played in the traumatic experience itself. It was also interesting to her because she would get to see who this Ezra person was. She'd be lying to herself if she denied some fascination in what sort of person could get Crowley to use the pet name Angel, unironically.
"Don't take it personally," he drawled, and she realized she hadn't given a response. "He wants to meet everyone. He likes people."
"Aha," she said. She nodded. She was still reasoning through what would be in her client's best interest, working hard to separate that from her own professionally unwarranted curiosity. "And what do you think about that?"
"I think he stays in London, you stay in New York."
This was another one of those mysteries about her client that she could not solve. He seemed to defy basic geography. He dropped enough references to make clear that he did, indeed, spend most of his time in England. She couldn't imagine the cost of so many transatlantic flights, but he clearly had the means. What really made her mind buckle was the exorbitant amount of time he must spend flying back and forth. Here, she supposed, was an explanation. It was worth the cost for him to make sure he never ran into her except on his terms. She would have been wrong, she supposed, to expect anything less dramatic and over the top from him. "There might be a time later when it would be useful for him to join us," she said, "but it would be entirely up to you, only if you wanted to." He shrugged. "Is he going to pressure you into letting him come?"
"So what sort of ground rules would you find mutually acceptable?" he said. So apparently they were back on that.
"Well," she thought about it, "it should happen at the start of the session. Sorry, but that's what I think."
"What if you want to end early?"
She scowled at him. He still expected her to run screaming.
I won't, she said.
That a promise?
He asked, and it almost sounded mocking. She couldn't put her finger on what it was, but there was a strange tinge to it, like he was walking her into a trap she couldn't perceive.
Sure,
she said, because despite the way he was making her feel right now, she couldn't see any reason not to offer this promise. She was a professional, after all.
Fine, he sighed out, and he now sounded really disappointed.
He shifted in his seat again, leaning forward, closer to her.
You should be more careful who you make promises to, Aubrey Time.
She could not understand what had just happened. She could not understand what she had done to lose Herb. She knew, however, if she asked, he wouldn't give an answer.
What would you need to feel safe?
She asked, trying to get back on track. He shrugged. He was agitated.
If you'd like, she'd try again. We could practice today. We could try it out, do everything just like we would next time, only without you actually taking them off.
Maybe, he said, fidgeting and looking around.
Maybe. His name's not actually Ezra, you know.
God damn, she thought.
What? She said.
Ezra. That's not actually his name. That's just what I told you.
She had almost forgotten how much of a liar he was. She had almost let that slip her mind. She felt like a hack.
Do you want to tell me what his name really is?
No.
Okay.
It's Aziraphale.
God damn, she thought again.
Ezra, what was that?
Aziraphale.
He sounded it out slower. One name, all one word. Aziraphale.
That's an unusual name, she said stupidly.
He shrugged. Not where we're from.
Aubrey Time spent a month once touring Europe. It included a weekend in England. She was pretty certain Aziraphale is not in any way a common name there.
Well, thank you for telling me the truth, she said, even more stupidly.
He shrugged. So we practice, huh? Just play act?
Yes.
She nodded. His deflection tactics were so obvious. In retrospect, it annoyed her how they worked. But at least she could see how it had benefited the therapeutic process this time. It had given him time to think things through. By the end of the session, they had their ground rules.
Cat eyes, she thought. That's how she saw them. Cat eyes.
It would only be later, after the session had ended, when she was writing up her notes, that she would realize her mistake. That she would recontextualize the tattoo on the side of his face, the occasional speech impediment he tried to hide, and the thematic choice he made with his accessories. Later, she would groan and rethink so much of what she understood about him. But for now, in the session, what she saw was that he had cat eyes. He had cat eyes, and they were very, very angry cat eyes. She didn't say anything. This was one of their ground rules. He had said it was all right if she screamed, but he didn't want her to comment on them. So long as his eyes were uncovered, she wouldn't talk. So she didn't. She also hadn't screamed, and she could tell that mattered. They were unnerving to look at, in particular because of how much anger they contained. But they were also beautiful. Another ground rule he had insisted on. She was not at any point to say that they were beautiful. She was not to compliment them in any way. It was not easy to keep eye contact with him, given how angry he was. It was hard to look at such angry eyes and keep her composure. It mattered, though. This was what all her professional experience was for, to maintain her composure in moments like this. And, furthermore, Aubrey Time understood that her client wasn't angry at her. She understood. She really did. He was angry at himself. He was angry at his eyes. He was angry that he was so scared. Anthony Crowley, at this moment, was terrified of Aubrey Time in a way, she suspected. He was almost never terrified of anything. He was terrified of what she could do to him, how she could break him, how she could let him down and reject him. He was terrified, and he was angry that he was terrified. But Aubrey Time would not let him down. She wouldn't. They had settled on a timer. He had originally suggested a full minute, timed out, of eye contact. She had warned him, however, that a full minute of uninterrupted eye contact, especially without any talking, could feel like an eternity. There had been some rounds of bargaining, which concluded with them agreeing to a total of 43 seconds. Now, she could tell, from the tenor of the anger in those eyes, she should have pushed harder for less time. He was in pain. The timer dinged. He put the glasses back on. She took a deep breath, and he did too. "Well," she said. He sighed out. "You didn't scream." "I didn't run away." "You should have." This wasn't the first time he had said something like this. This was a defense mechanism of his. He would crawl behind this image he had of himself as some terrifying and dangerous person whenever he felt too vulnerable. It was her professional opinion that there would be a time in the future when she would call him on it. But not now. "So," she said, holding out her hands as if to say, "you know the ground rules. Tell me what you're thinking."
"I'm thinking you should have run."
She nodded. "And?"
"I'm thinking I want to take a nap."
Third time's a charm, she thought. "And?"
"I'm thinking it wasn't that bad."
"Not that bad," she repeated. He shrugged and said nothing, so she pushed. "Thank you for trusting me."
He shrugged again and said nothing, so she pushed again.
"Crowley, thank you."
He mumbled something which she interpreted as, "No big deal."
"What is it like to trust me?" she asked. Something played across his face, but she couldn't read it. He was uncomfortable, and he was hiding something from her.
He was always hiding something from her. He was a liar, after all. But now, she thought, he was feeling bad about it. "There are some things you don't know about me," he said.
He sounded cautious and frightened. He sounded like a child who had been slapped for asking for supper. "I know, Crowley," she said. She soothed. She reassured. She smiled. "I've known from day one."
"You wouldn't like me if you really knew me," he said.
"Crowley," she said this like she was calling out to him. She moved to try to catch his eyes, even through his glasses. She wanted to make sure he saw that she was smiling, that there was warmth in her smile, that it was warmth intended just for him. "I do know you. I see you. I know you." He didn't believe her. Not thoroughly, not entirely, but she could see he believed her enough. Not much, but enough.